The invitation and the introduction, he said, I'm on the far left, but I purposely chose Yom Revi'i, middle of the week, right there, right in the middle, Mittwoch, which is where I like to find myself. I want to thank Rabbi Kalinsky for putting together such a wonderful program. It's been a fantastic Shabbos for me to come out here. It's obviously a very touchy, very sensitive subject. Across America today, people are very jittery over the accusations that seem to emerge every day and without end, especially in the realm of sexual harassment. It's something that this country has never experienced before in any meaningful way. The accused either confess in whole or in part, with their careers and reputations ruined, or they deny everything, and their careers and reputations are also ruined. There's some who say, many fine people, and part of me agrees with it also, that they get what they deserve, even though we've created for ourselves an alternate justice system. On the other hand, there's the presumption of innocence also, and it's the alternate justice system which should trouble, at least on some level, all of us. The fact is, there was a time when if one had a grievance against another, if it was criminal, it'd be prosecuted. If it was civil, it'd be sued. And now that's been completely bypassed, and another approach has been taken, which we can call loosely public shaming. Public shaming is an accusation that's made by someone, either anonymously or they're named, against an individual for perceived wrongs. Now, when I suggested the topic a few months ago, I had absolutely no idea there'd be this explosion where every day something happens. It started in the media, made its way to Hollywood, back to the media, into politics, and media and Hollywood. It's all over. I heard rumors that at the Oscars this year, they're going to give to any director or actor over 75 years old with no accusation of harassment a Lifetime Achievement Award. All right, you heard it here first. But what we're dealing with really is trial by media. I put in my handout social in parentheses because media happens to be more regulated. Social media is almost completely unregulated. But those who cannot be prosecuted in law are being persecuted in the media. And the fact is, from the accused perspective, it's easier. It feels better. Sometimes it's more lucrative. And the results are more devastating to the accused. Public shaming can be more effective even than a lawsuit or a criminal conviction, for that matter, especially when there's no means of defense, which is the whole point. Now, it's a dominant force today, social media. As Lou mentioned, he's not on it. I try to stay off it as well. There are positive aspects to it. Obviously, it's been a revolution in modern life. There's the spread of information, of ideas, of contacts. I read in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, for example, that a woman wrote that part of the reason why so many women today are emboldened to come forward is because they communicate with each other privately on social media, and each one encourages the other, and there's a support group, which you wouldn't have 10, 20, 50 years ago. So therefore, it makes it easier to make the accusations and gain justice that way. As a negative, many negatives in a variety of ways. I mean, I've found this young people, for example, because of the internet, social media, find it much more difficult to have real relationships with each other. They can't talk or speak as normal human beings used to do. Someone sent me a cartoon last week that so many people today use the letter U instead of Y-O-U, right? U. And the cartoon was, now that you write U, what instead of Y-O-U, what do you do with all that extra time? All right? And And of course, as you saw on the PowerPoint, bullying, but a byproduct of this is trial by media as well. You can ruin a person's life before they even knew what hit them. And society has its self-appointed watchdogs that monitor this. If you just look at number 10 in the handout, an article in the New York Times Magazine about 2.5 years ago, And I won't mention any of the names, but you see at the very beginning, public shaming was basically outlawed around the time of the revolution. The stocks, the pillory, the whipping post, the lot. Sometimes I think that duels are a little more civilized than what we have today. At least it's a fair fight. But no, Benjamin Rush, who is a colleague and friend of Benjamin Franklin, wrote, "Ignominy is universally acknowledged to be a worse punishment than death." Meaning shaming is worse than death. Now, had he studied the Talmud, he might not have come to that conclusion, but it's a good argument. If you turn the page, look at number 20. Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Mem Hei Amud Aleph, so the case that they're dealing with is the execution of a man or a woman. So stoning involved throwing a person off a higher point, at least 6-8 feet high, to the ground, and if that didn't kill them, then they throw a stone on them, a boulder, to hasten their death. So a man was unclothed from the waist up, so stone would directly contact the flesh. What about a woman? So the Gemara has a machlokas, whether a woman be shamed if she was unclothed from the waist up. So that's the machlokas. Mar savar bizyoni de inish adifale minicha de gufe. One opinion held that humiliation, psychological anguish, is worse than physical pain. So if the woman's death was delayed even a few seconds and she suffered more pain, she'd rather have that than suffer the humiliation of being unclothed. Where the other opinion was, nicha de gufe odif mi bizyone. Now, physical pain is worse than psychological pain. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me. But you see, it's a good machlokas. And I'm not sure whether there's a universal standard. Different people may feel different things. The particular case the Times was writing about was of a woman whom I won't name. Her last name is in the sections that I copied here. She was a tweeter, all right? And she was the head of human resources for a company, which made it even more sweeter to the troll that outed her. And she was flying from America to South Africa via London. And in London, she tweeted a racist remark. What she didn't think it was racist, but it came out as a racist remark. By the time she landed in Johannesburg, unknown to her, this was happening. By the time she landed, she was fired from her job and being pilloried across the globe. And the magazine piece really speaks about her and what happened. Now, the one who outed her was a person, he's named here as well, who does this for a living or sport. He trolls the internet looking for words or phrases that will make perfect strangers look bad, and then he publicizes it, and others join on, pile on, until the person's life is ruined. Notice what he said about ruining her life. Everyone's attention span is so short, they'll be mad about something new today. But of course, what destroyed her is what she was exploiting as well. And if you look at the last line, their motivation, the trolls, was the same as hers, a bid for the attention of strangers. And that, of course, is a modern malady. It's not enough to have a circle of friends and confidants. You want perfect strangers to hear of you, know of you, and that becomes destructive to us. As you saw from Lou's introduction, the internet can be used as a weapon against others without the accuser even revealing his identity or her identity to the public. And even if it's defamatory, which would not be, make the person civilly liable, it's very hard to discover the poster. And as noted, the courts have placed significant hurdles before forcing website owners to reveal the identity of the posters. I should mention one other point before we get back to this, and that's a California case, a Supreme Court case, Stagna versus California from 2003. So I talk about it in shul, but Marion Stagna was a child molester, a pervert, had a long run, 1955 to 1973, including his own children. The statute of limitations expired in 1976, but in 1993, California passed a law, revised its law, allowing for retroactive prosecution for child sex crimes. and Stagner was indicted and convicted, but he appealed on the basis that the ex post facto law was violated. The Supreme Court ruled in 2003 by 5-4 vote in Stagner's favor. Now, the minority, both good svaris on each side, the minority held that the ex post facto clause of the Constitution applies only to a new crime, not an existing crime that simply can't be prosecuted because of the statute. But the majority, written by Justice O'Connor, held no, that if you think about the ex post facto clause and what it is indigned to preclude, it exists to provide adequate warning to the defendant to preserve evidence and witnesses and to ensure that anyone is free from prosecution after a certain date. Now, we may feel that certain crimes should not have any statute, which is fine. On the other hand, the reality is that if you prosecute someone, or sue someone for that matter, 30, 40, 50 years after the crime, if you accuse someone publicly after they're infirm or dead, then they really have no means of mounting a defense. So Justice O'Connor held that the theory that underlies the ex post facto clause would preclude these types of retroactive prosecutions as well. Newt, what does the Torah say? So the Torah has no statute of limitations at all. You could always prosecute, but the Torah has a very strict burden of evidence, and that's number one, lo yakum eid echad ba'ish. You cannot have one witness come forward. Al pi shnei dim or pi shlosha dim yakum davar. You need two witnesses. You need testimonial proof. That becomes a modern problem. So what do you do? What remedies do we have with the aged miscreant, with a crime committed years past when there's no longer evidence or credible testimony? What are we doing? There's only one witness. It's a he said, she said. So even our world, the Jewish world, is not very subtle or discreet. We're not averse to using the internet or social media to expose alleged crimes or criminals, sometimes after they're dead, but almost always when they have no means of mounting a defense. And as we know, innuendo is sufficient to destroy a person's reputation. So what are our parameters that we use? Do we believe, does the Torah believe in public shaming? If yes, who has the right to do it? Well, it's interesting that we do have a concept of public shaming. And I can't go through each one, but I'll just hit the highlights and you could look up the sources on your own. So for example, in the number two, the Shulchan Aruch Hashem Mishpat, in Siman Reish Dalid, if a person breaches a contract and does it habitually so that he does not stand by his word, then he can be publicly outed as a person with whom others should not do business. He's a violation of the curse of Mishapara, that whoever, God, who collected, so to speak, who punished the generation of the flood, he will punish those who are not omdim b'diburam, who do not stand by their word. And note the Rama at the end, Yehoshom Sha'omer lo barabim, he's told this in public. And the Rambam says, emphasize the Parashat Mishnah in Bava Metzia, in the fourth parak, b'fnei tzibur b'nei adam, you get up in public and do it as well. Next, you look at number seven, in Evan Ezer, Simon Ayin Aleph, if Aleph, if a man, a father, refused to pay child support, he's in arrears. Look at the underlined part. Im lo rotza garen bo, umachlimen oso, upotzrin bo. We rebuke him. We shame him. We pester him. Vim lo rotza, if he still doesn't want to pay, machrizen ola betzibur. We publicly announce that this person is cruel and he does not want to support his children. Number five and six have another case of public shaming. That's the Moredes, a wife who refuses to engage in conjugal relations with her husband for no valid reason. So she is first chastised by Beis Din, she has money deducted from her ksuba, and then if she still refuses, machrizen olea arba shabbosos zo achar zo, four shabbosos in a row, they announce in public. Rashi says it's done in the shuls and the batei medrash, it's announced so-and-so is refusing conjugal relations with her husband. I should note parenthetically that in shuls today, if they announced fathers who are in arrears and child support, and women who were refusing relations with their husbands, if they did it during the Haftorah, you'd eliminate the Kiddush Club, because nobody would want to leave shul. They'd want to hear every week the list of those week's miscreants.
That's a good idea.
Good idea. And you don't have some front of you, right? You heard it here first. The Gemara says, in Yoma daf peivavam et beis, mefarsimin es ha-chanofim nechil Hashem. If Beis Din knows of a particular person who walks around as if he's righteous, but they know he's corrupt, then they have an obligation to go public and say, don't trust this person, don't learn from this person either. But all the cases I mentioned involve a Beis Din. They involve a tribunal, a panel, that on some level hears evidence, even if it doesn't reach the threshold of evidence that would satisfy the Beis Din for conviction or fine or some type of compensation, nonetheless they act upon it. What about individual shaming? Does a person have the right to go forward and say and accuse, even anonymously, certainly publicly, explicitly, I accuse this person of doing offensive, repugnant acts towards me? Well, that brings us to the realm of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is not Motzi Shemra. Motzi Shemra is an accusation that is true, that is false against another person. Lashon Hara is the dissemination of true but disparaging information about someone. That is to say, information that will tend to cause the listener to think poorly of the subject. And that's exactly the world we're living through now. It's a terrible sin. Makabel Lashon Hara, Meod, Mesaper Lashon Hara, Gemara Makos Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph. It's very destructive to people, to society, and to the Jewish polity. But note, if Lashon Hara is disseminated, one is not allowed to believe it, but one is able to be choshesh for it. You can act in reliance on that information. And here you have a famous Gemara in Nida, Daf Samech Aleph, Amid Aleph, number 11. Omar Rava, Hai Lishno Bisha, Afal Pi, Dil Kibuli Lo Miboy, Mechosh Le Miboy. Lashon Hara, even if you can't accept it, you can be choshesh for it. You can act in reliance on it. And Gemara is a case where a group of murderers came and asked Rabbi Tarfon to hide them, and he said, and they admitted, and they said, because the rumors, they may have denied it, and he said, if I don't hide them, they'll be caught and executed. If I do hide them, I'm endangering myself, because even though it's Lashon Hara, I can't believe it, nonetheless I can act in reliance on it. And in the end, he just told them, go hide yourselves. So there has to be some intermediate stage, a balance between this harmful information that's disseminated on the one hand, and on the other hand, our ability to say, well, maybe there's something to it, and therefore we should act. That's the Meiri in number 12, that who says, L'mechash le mi boy shema hadavar emes. That he, Rabbi Tarfon, had to be choshesh for it. Maybe it's true. If it's true, we don't want to harbor murderers. So we are able to do that. But you run into another problem, and that's in 13. Mar Psachim Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, the second line. There are three types of people that God hates. One, the hypocrite. Says one thing and then does another. Two, Hayodeh Edus B'Chaver of Eino Meidlo, someone who knows testimony that will help someone and he says nothing. But the third is Haroa Dvar Erva B'Chavero Umeid Bo Yechidi, a person who knows something unseemly that another did and he testifies him against as a solitary witness. Why? A solitary witness means nothing. So the case is, Zigud came and said that Tuvia sinned in some immoral way. And they flogged Zigud, not Tuvia, the miscreant. And he said, Tuvia chata v'zigud mingad. He sinned and I'm flogged. And Rav Papa said, yes, because all you did was talk Lashon Hara against him. There's no other witness. Now, there's an important source in 14, the Pischei Tshuva. I need like another 5 minutes or so. It'll be good. Yeah, we're good?
Please.
Okay. The Pischei Tshuva in Aruch Chaim Kuf Nun Vav, 19th century, Israel Isserlein, And you know, the 19th century Chafetz Chaim came out with a sefer, and we'll look at it in a little while, against Lashon Hara, Shmir Sa Lashon, trying to get us to guard our speech. The Pischei Tshuva took the opposite approach. And he said, he wants to mention here, if you have time and a magnifying glass, you could look at it. Number 14, he says, I wanted to mention here that all the Sifrei Musar today are screaming about the sin of Lashon Hara. But Anochi Marisha Olam Lehipuch, and I want to scream that the world should know something else, a greater sin than Lashon Hara, and that is Menias Atzmo Miladaber B'Mokam Anitzrach LaHatzas HaOshrik Miad Oshko. There's a greater sin Lashon Hara, and that is remaining silent when someone's being victimized, and you know the victimizer, and you can help them. It's worse. So he took almost the opposite approach, the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim says, say nothing until you could verify that it's mutter to say and there's a benefit. The Pischei Tshuva said, no. L'chadchila, what we should do is try to prevent victims from feeling that there's no support network, that no one's going to believe them, that they can't say anything. No. You have to speak out to save the oppressed. And only then, when after you say there's no other way to do it, or there is, or if there is another way to do it, then you have to avoid the sins of Lashon Hara. And the examples that they give, you know, someone is going to cheat someone, someone's going to ambush someone, someone's going to burglarize someone. Would anyone think that you can't say something to thwart the crime? Of course not. So what happens? You have to go forward immediately when you know someone is a criminal and expose them that way. Well, it's interesting that we have two famous sexual harassment cases in the Jewish history, both in the 1400s, and that's on the next page, on number 15. First is the Ma'arik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, who was one of the great poskim in Italy in the 1400s, died around 1480. So his case, it's in Siman Kuf Peches in the Shut of the Maharik. His case involved a man named Rav Aaron Riskia, who was accused by a woman of, I guess, of risque conduct. All right? And there was no other evidence or testimony against him. And apparently the woman had a reputation for, I guess we'd say, vampish behavior. She'd done this with other men as well. The community had distanced themselves from this Rav Aaron Riskia, and the Ma'arik came out full-throated in his defense, that he did nothing wrong. You cannot believe this woman. There's no evidence. Anyone who tries to shame him, they weren't giving an Aliyah in Shul, they should ask forgiveness from him, because he is completely clear, pure, and innocent. Now, I note parenthetically that if someone has a bad reputation, Beis Din is allowed to act just on that. And that's at the bottom, number 17. The Rambam in Hilchas Sanhedrin, Perek Chav Dalet, Halacha Hei, V'chein Yesh LeBeis Din B'chol Mokom B'chol Zman L'Halkos Odom Sheshmuoso Ra. If someone has a bad reputation for some type of misconduct, whether it's a sexual or financial or aggressive, and the people are murmuring about him, that he's over on Arayos and other things, and it's a kol shein aposek, it's a sound that doesn't stop, right? Which is really the internet. Then Beis Din has the right to give him malkos. Malkin alo tova shmua. And that, in fact, comes up in the next case. They didn't get malkos in the Rivash in 16. Rivash was one of the gedolim of Spain in the late 14th century. 1391, he had to flee Spain because of the riots and pogroms. He moved to Algeria. And in the shut of the Rivash, Rabbi Yitzhak Bar Shesha, Simon Reish Samich Hei, he had this case. And everyone is named. There was a woman, Al-Johar, the wife of Rabbi Yaakov ben Joseph, and she raised a claim against Rabbi Yitzhak Kohen. Okay? Rabbi Yitzhak Kohen apparently was, no other way to say it, was harassing her, trying to seduce her. And he lays out the bill of particulars. He wanted relations. And if she said no, she was married, Tein li neshika achad, at least kiss me so I don't die. And it would happen again and again. And then it paused. You see in the text, I underlined it. She said nothing for 6 years. After 6 years, it resumed. They were neighbors. And then she went to the Beis Din. The Beis Din asked her, as happens in these cases, where were you for 6 years? And she said she was afraid of her husband. That shalais kotet imo v'yagu zeh zeh. She's afraid that her husband would confront this Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen and someone would wind up dead. This being the Middle East after all. Someone would wind up dead and therefore she said nothing. Was there corroboration? Yes. When it happened, she reached out to a neighbor, Anshmuel, the son of Al-Raviach, and he came and testified. He doesn't know what happened. He never saw any sexual harassment. But what he can say is she told him right then, 6 years earlier, that this was happening, that this man was not leaving her alone. The Beis Din ruled, the Rivash ruled, that in fact, she's not to be believed that it's true. You can't even, because she did something wrong, but nonetheless, he cannot talk to her again, order protection. He cannot live in the shchuna, the neighborhood. He has to move somewhere else. And if he ever talks to her again, or comes to proximity, then he'll get malchus. Interestingly, this was codified in the Shulchan Aruch at the very end of Evan HaEzer, in Kuf Ayin Ches, Sif Chaf, that if a married woman comes, as a man is pestering her, you don't have to believe her. But the accused, he could be banished. He could be sent to a different community to live, and eventually he could be flogged if he persists in the conduct. All right, so just briefly to close, the Chafetz Chaim in number 19 in Hilchas Rechilas Klal Tes, you find this in Hilchas Lashon Hara as well, but he has criteria by which a person can reveal Lashon Hara. There's seven criteria. One, you have to have first-hand knowledge and be completely certain that there was an evil act, which is really the victim. You can't exaggerate. The intention has to be to benefit others and avoid harm to the innocent. There cannot be any other way to achieve the same benefit or avoid the same harm. And the subject, meaning the accused, cannot be harmed worse than he deserves. You have those seven criteria. So now we come to a problem. It's arguable how the recent wave of accusations meet this standard. There's a toelis. What's the classic toelis? Future harm. Certainly to a child, but future harm. If you know a man is a predator, then you have to come forward, even as a single witness. You have to publicize it because he might harm other people. But vengeance is not a toelis. We would never say such a thing, even though it feels good. Feeling good and vindicated is not a toelis. It could very well be that airing abuse to a therapist or to family members is a toelis. And certainly airing it to the authorities if there's fear of future abuse or if a crime was committed. Lashon Hara applies even if the victim publicly confronts the accused. Certainly it's more problematic if the victim remains anonymous. But remember, loss of dignity is worse, according to some, than loss of physical pain. So in conclusion, I would just say it's a challenging area. We can't let social media erase from the Torah all the laws of Lashon Hara and Rechilus, because that's when it becomes a tool for bullying, for revenge, even for libel. We shouldn't be so self-righteous that we blithely permit to ourselves and fail to consider that this type of frontier justice is unworthy of a serious Jew. Again, I reiterate, the clearest heter is in the case of imminent harm or possible future harm, whether to a child or to an adult. Now, in Israel, they established this Forum Takana, which is a rabbinic body, well, rabbinic, I shouldn't say, involved, there's some women on also, a body that investigates and hears accusations of sexual abuse where there is no corroboration. And I think, all in all, it's a very good process, although, frankly, I personally would be more inclined or supported even more if they had actually trained investigators or judges rather than just Rabbanim listening to the cases. So it's not perfect, but it's very useful and it's very important, and at least this is a way when there can't be criminal accusations or a civil lawsuit to get the miscreants out of public life. And is it possible that sometimes the halacha will say that this cannot be publicized because the accused is dead or old or infirm or can otherwise cause no harm to any future victim? And the answer is yes. And that's when we remind ourselves that yesh din v'yesh dayan, there's justice, there's a judge, capital J, and the judge always has the final say, Baruch Dayan HaMes, always. I thank you all very much.
Yeshkoach, Rabbi Pruzansky.